Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The Fabrication of a Saint. Native peoples horrified over canonization of Junipero Serra, whom they say is responsible for genocide. And with us is Dr. Christine Grabowski. She's an anthropologist and the principal of Grabowski and Associates, a consulting firm that focuses exclusively on issues of concern to Indian country. She provides anthropological, historical, and genealogical research and analysis on diverse issues, for example, land into trust applications, governance, and tribal membership, as well as federal acknowledgement. Well, let's begin by the fabrication of a saint. There has been a great deal of consternation coming, if you will, from Indian country at the sanctification of Junipero Serra. Tell us what the problem is and why it has evoked the ire of the indigenous population.
Well, the Catholic Church has canonized Junipero Serra, and for people who don't know too much about the history of California, Serra was a missionary who was brought in 1769 to establish missions in what was then called Alta California, which is above what today is the border between Mexico and the United States. And the system that he installed there as Padre Presidente, the father president of the missions, was in fact extremely brutal and oppressive for the Indians. And the native community is, especially the ones who descend from the 21 missions that were in operation during the mission period from 1769 to 1833, when they were abolished by the Mexican independent government. They're pretty horrified that you would, that the Pope, he's done all of these progressive, has done many progressive acts regarding peoples in different places, and yet, you know, seems to have turned a blind eye when it comes to California. Regarding the church's own hand at what resulted in more than 150,000 deaths of Indians while confined at the missions. So, in essence, they're horrified that someone would be elevated to sainthood who is responsible for such death, suffering, destruction of culture, of people, of lands, et cetera. I mean, it's just truly horrific. And I will say that my practice, I do work all over the country, and I do have clients in California. And I have worked with the mission documents. So I know personally baptismal records, death, marriage records. Sometimes the case requires my going back to the 1700s or early 1800s to investigate these issues. And so I was, as a researcher, knew of the horrific story at the missions. I mean, they're viewed as tourist attractions in California, pretty white buildings with red tile roofs. And we, of course, have even a furniture called after the mission period furniture. And virtually every shopping center in California is in the quote-unquote mission style. But they were forced labor camps. So I myself was pretty horrified when I heard that the Pope, Pope Francis, of all people, would be canonizing Serra. I said, how can this be? How can this be? So that's the origin. If you'd like, I can say something, give a brief history of the missions themselves.
No, I think it's imperative that you do.
Okay. The missions... the history of the missions actually start a couple of hundred years before they actually get started and established. And they start with something called the Papal Bulls, which a lot of people don't know about, but they should. In essence, they were edicts from the Pope, one in 1452 and another one in 1493, the year after Columbus. And they, in essence, those bulls gave the moral and legal authority to Christian sovereigns to go out and, this is a quote, to capture, vanquish, and subdue the Saracens, pagans, and other enemies of Christ, and put them into perpetual slavery, and to take all of their possessions and their property. This was the driving force of all colonialism that took place from the Christian nations of Europe, in the Americas, in Asia, in Africa, Far East. That was the driving force. And what's really important about that, those papal bulls, is that in essence they denied the non-Christians any humanity. They weren't people. You could do whatever you want to them. You could take their land. You could kill them. You could take their property. They weren't eligible for, they weren't deserving of any respect because they were non-Christian, right? Only because they were non-Christians. And that's pretty heavy stuff. And that's the reason why the Spanish come, that's why the English come, that's why the French come, including the Dutch, why they all come to the Americas. With this driving force, it occurs actually in the 1500s. So let's scroll forward to the 1700s. Spain is already in America, in New Spain. And by the way, there's a really good book about this by Stephen Newcomb called Pagans in the Promised Land. And he also has a film that just came out on it about this doctrine of discovery. But anyway, so you have Spain in New Spain, centered in Mexico, what today is Mexico. And it's trying to defend its territory because although they can go off and take the land of non-Christians with impunity, they have to jockey and with the other European nations. So to the east, they have the French in Louisiana, and they don't want the French coming over and claiming parts of New Spain. So they establish some missions in what today is Texas, specifically because they didn't have people to go and establish settlements. But they said, well, we'll go out, we'll convert some of the Indians, we'll make them into Spanish citizens, they'll have towns, and that will be, in essence, our stake in the soil. Because obviously, you need something more than a flag saying it's ours. You need people on the ground to make it yours. And that's what they did in Texas. And they also went the other way west. And in the 1700s, the Spanish were afraid of the Russians who were up north in fur trade, and they were going to come south down from what today is Washington State, Oregon, in Northern California. So the driving force was to establish missions in what was then called Alta California. What's really important is that now Sarah is charged with going and establishing missions, and he goes there with accompanied by military in 1769. The year before that occurs, there were Jesuit missionaries in Baja California, the Baja Peninsula, and they were kicked out, yanked back to Spain because the Spanish crown thought that they were enriching themselves at the expense of the Spanish crown. And so they were yanked back, and Franciscans and Dominicans were replaced with them. And what's very important about this part of the story is that Franciscans and Dominicans were given significantly less power because the Spanish crown didn't want them to repeat what the Jesuits had done. And that's a very important part of the story vis-a-vis Sarah, because from the very beginning, he chafes by not having enough power over the missionary enterprise, if you will. So in 1769, Sarah, along with this military commander and a bunch of soldiers, sail up the coast of California. And at first, the Indians are very welcoming. They're curious. They help them. They give them food, et cetera. But he goes there with soldiers. They're not settlements. They're not women and children. They're just Spanish soldiers. And the Spanish soldiers do dastardly deeds to the Indians, including lassoing them, raping the women, and then killing the men when they try to defend their women folk. That really put a kibosh on the missionary attraction. So Sarah understandably wasn't too happy about that. He's trying to encourage people to come in, and it's the military aren't acting very welcoming, if you will. So there is some friction between the two. But Sarah's missionary system in California is very different than anywhere else. And this is where the Catholic Church has said, oh, Sarah, he was a man of his time. He was doing, you know, in essence, implying that what he was doing was repeated anywhere else where there was missionization. And that's simply not true. In Texas, the missions were established. The men who came from Mexico came with their families. They had wives, which was, in essence, a civilizing influence upon them. The Indians, when they came to the missions, they lived in family units. And from the very beginning, that was not Sarah's plan. Sarah's plan was, once you came in, you weren't leaving. It was involuntary confinement at the missions, literally locked in mission compounds. The men were separated from the women. The women were locked in these dormitories, fetid, airless dormitories, where they were then abused by the soldiers who had the keys, who were supposedly looking over them. They couldn't leave. They had to work for the missions, for the clergy and for the soldiers. They didn't own anything that they produced. All of it went to the soldiers and the missionaries, and then only what they deemed appropriate would they give back. And at first, the missions were not self-supporting, because the missionaries and the soldiers really didn't know about California land, et cetera, and how to use it. So the agriculture that they embarked on wasn't successful, and there was really a great deal of starvation. Now, since the Indians were at the bottom of the rung, they couldn't eat unless the fathers gave them something. They literally were starved. And when they ran away, or attempted to run away, they would literally be beaten and shackled. And there are accounts in the records of the Spanish kept records of this, and say, well, why did you run away? Well, it's because my wife, my son, they all died of starvation. And when I cried, they whipped me. That's why they ran away. And this kind of account is repeated over and over again. And I can tell you that when I was working with the records at one of the missions, I was pretty chilled by the fact that when you look at these baptismal records, you see that a woman gave birth to 7 kids over a few years, and every one of them died. And it's just like, you know, I'm a mother. I can't imagine that every one of my children dying. And when Mexican women came, when Spanish women came, they gave birth, their children weren't dying. So clearly there was something very wrong. And what I later discovered is that in Sarah's own writing, I didn't even believe it at first, because it was, what do you mean you didn't give them anything but milk? Nobody lives on just milk. And he was giving that to adults also. That's all they had, and that's all they was going to give them. So the situation in the missions was pretty horrific. Not only were they imprisoned for life and separated from their families, but the overall death rate is estimated by a demographer, Robert Jackson, as 90%. The average lifespan for children at some of the missions was an average 4.5 years. At others, it was 7. It was literally a catastrophic collapse of the population. And Sarah, in his own writing, is he upset by this? He notices that they're all dying. He notices that the Gentile or the wild Indians were much healthier than the ones at the prisons. But he almost gleefully says, well, that we have a large harvest of souls. So his concern is that these bodiless souls have floated to heaven, and he seems to have virtually no regard for the people when they're living, which is truly astounding. And of course, what the Indians thought of this is never discussed. So life at the missions was a pretty horrific experience. And I'll give you a quote from someone. They were shackled. They were beaten, forced to work all day, all the time. Loads of the kids had hernias, all right, from their overwork. And here's a quote of an Englishman who comes by in 1826. And he says that the congregation was arranged on both sides of the building, separated by an aisle where several deputies were stationed with whips, canes, and goads to preserve order and to keep everyone kneeling in a kneeling posture. The end of the church was occupied by guards or of soldiers under their arms with fixed bayonets. That was a church service. And quite a number of contemporary observers discussed how utterly depressed and subservient these people were. I mean, it was truly horrific. I mean, imagine you can never escape. So those are the conditions. And I knew about these conditions from my research over the years, and it's widely published in academic literature, not by Catholic universities, of course, but in non-Catholic literature. So when I heard that the church was going to canonize the person who started this system, I really just scratched my head. How could this be? Just how could this be?
And what efforts were made to educate, if you will, to, or maybe that's foolish on my part, perhaps the education was well in place and it didn't matter, but what efforts were made to talk, to contact the Pope towards the prevention of the canonization of Junipero Serra?
Well, there are three parts, there are three stages to canonization. One is, the first one is veneration, that took place in the 1940s. The second was beatification, which took place in 1988, and the third now is canonization. All along, there was great pushback and opposition by natives. But clearly, right now, there's more because of social media, because the Native community is more well-educated, there's been more research, it's been disseminated better, they're more politically active to begin with. So, for example, there's Chairman Valentin Lopez from the Amamutsun Tribal Band. He started writing letters to the Pope when he heard about this. Actually, he started writing letters to the Pope even before the announcement went forth. And he started writing letters to the Pope because he and his tribe are descendants from Mission Santa Cruz and Mission San Juan Bautista, outlining the objections. And I myself went with him to see the Holy See in New York and lay forth our objections. He participated. He gave it what's called an intervention, a report before the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues back in May. Was very well received. It's on YouTube. So there's been a huge amount of pushback, and more recently, 55 tribes in California have written letters to the Pope, and the California Tribal Chairman's Southern California Tribal Chairman's Association unanimously wrote a letter opposing the canonization, and the California Association of Tribal Governments has also come out. All the members have written a letter opposing the canonization. This is not, you know, it's maybe not covered here on the East Coast very much, but it's a very big issue in California.
Why is it so important, Christine? How does it fit into the contemporary situation, these missions, Junipero Serra? What does it mean for the indigenous population today, such that there must be this kind of critique? And unfortunately, the canonization has occurred. So where should we be going from here?
Well, it's important because there's something called historic trauma, which the Native community, in fact, suffers from, which is not unlike if you don't acknowledge that you've been sexually abused and, you know, and the perpetrator is not brought forward, then in essence, there's just continuing pain from no one acknowledging the truth of your situation. And that's the situation here. When I saw that the Catholic Church was calling him, calling Sarah a friend of the Indians, and he walked all the way to Mexico City on their behalf. I thought to myself, well, this is pretty bizarre. How could this be? Let me look at the documents. And what I discovered was something pretty alarming. I was trying to find the exact document that they were referring to, and I quickly discovered that the Catholic websites were all talking about how Sarah was not only a friend of the Indian and defender of their rights, but he wrote something that could be termed, passive voice, an Indian Bill of Rights. And I went, whoa, an Indian Bill of Rights? I've never heard of such a thing. And what really caught my attention was that if there was, in fact, an Indian Bill of Rights, and they said it were 32 points, why were none of them discussing it? That, to me, was very suspicious. Why not proudly proclaim every one of those rights that he gave the Indians? Well, the short story is I did the research, and I wrote an article on it that appeared in Indian Country Today. It's called Sarah Gate and the Fabrication of a Saint. And, in fact, it's not true. And it's not only is it not true, we are talking about some low-level Catholic websites that dream this up. No, you have the archivist emeritus of the Los Angeles diocese using these terms. You have the Archbishop of San Diego using these terms. All right, insinuating and outright stating, the Catholic National Reporter stating that, in fact, yes, this is the first Bill of Rights for, you know, Indians in California. That's a blatant lie, quite frankly. I call it a fabrication, but, you know, if you have deliberately falsified the facts, it's a lie. The document is called Sarah did write a document called a representación. It's a representational report. I tracked it down. It does have 32 points. None of those points give rights to the Indians. All of them were put together to give administrative improvements to the missionary system, most important of which what Sarah asked for and what he got was exclusive control over the Indians. And before that, he was having a fight with the military commander. He wanted the military commander, whose name was Pedro Fajes, he wanted him fired and replaced, and that did occur. And he wanted exclusive authority over the Mission Indians, which he got. But the rest of the items are things like, I want more mules. I want the pay. You should give more pay to the soldiers.
Well,
we
Christine,
want a regular way of assessing the weights.
Christine, we're going to have to, unfortunately, leave it there. And I want to thank Christine Grabowski, who is the author of Sarah Gate, The Fabrication of a Saint, which is published in Indian Country Today. I encourage you to Google that, read the article material. And Christine, I know it's your anniversary and you're going to run to celebrate it. So congratulations.
Thank
and thank you for spending some time with us on these very, very interesting and important issues.
Here.
It's a pleasure to have you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
Buffy St. Marie. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.